Welcome to the Stonebridge Church Podcast. Watch us live every Sunday morning at 9:30 or 11:05 a.m. at gosblive.com. Or visit us in person. You can find directions at gostonebridge.com. Connect with us on our social media at facebook.com/gostonebridge and our Instagram at sbchurch.
Now, of course, you know that yesterday was the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 tragedy when those planes hit the trade towers in New York. And it's funny because, you know, when times like this come up, anniversaries come up, I think about where I was 20 years ago. You ever do that? So I can still remember walking through the living room area. The television was on, which was really unusual in the morning at my house, because if I'm not the one with the television on, it's not on. And so I'm walking by, and as I'm walking by, they're showing the burning of one of the towers because the plane has already hit. And I hear them say something like that, and but the cameras are on. Now they're watching, and there's smoke coming out. And all of a sudden, as I walk by, the second plane goes into the towers because they catch it live. And I still remember just kind of the shock of it and thinking, did that really happen? Is that real? Because I heard him talking about a plane hitting one of the towers. And I thought, well, that can't happen. It's New York City. You don't let planes go through there. And there, it's not like you would have missed it, right? They're there, you know. How could you have not, you know, seen that that's what you're going to run into? And part of me just said, I wonder if this is something that someone has made up. Have you ever done that? You know, I thought, you know, is this some kind of spoof that someone has sent out there and that didn't really happen, but they're kind of messing with us? And there's this reality that takes a while to sort of hit you about, you know, what has happened. And then there's this feeling of, and I, you know, a lot of this comes, you know, afterwards and for years afterwards. We should have known better. We should have known it was going to happen. We should have been able to predict. How could we have missed all the signs or all the, you know, things that led up to us? And it's just a reminder, you know, in life that there are a lot of things that come up and happen that you just can't predict. You just don't know those things are going to happen until they happen. And I think that part of it is it helps us to realize we're not in as much control as we thought we were. And that was certainly the intention of those in the attack, was to show America that America was not in control the way America thought America was in control. And I know we can take that as, well, that's a really bad thing. But sometimes, let's be honest, isn't that a really good thing? Because it points us to the fact that there must be someone else in control. It helps us to understand that if that's what our hope is, that I'm in control, that our nation is in control, that we can control all the events around us, then it makes us more vulnerable, if that's what we think. But Joseph, as we've been looking at his story, Joseph is the story of a man who realized he wasn't in control. You know, he had a great life, and everything was going really well, and all of a sudden his brothers, in their jealousy and their hatred of Joseph, they decide, here's the opportunity to get rid of him. Nothing new. You know, this is what people do all the time when they don't like something. If we can get rid of him, and so they got rid of him by selling him to some Ishmaelite traders who are headed down from the what we would call the further part of the east. They're headed down toward Egypt. In fact, here's a map that will pop up. And they're going to cross over in the land of Canaan on their way down to Egypt, because Egypt is the premier place. Egypt is the most powerful nation, you know, that anyone has ever seen at this time. Egypt is prosperous. And if you want to go sell, you know, slaves, man, Egypt is the perfect place to go and make some money and to sell someone like Joseph. So they take him down, they sell him. If you remember the story, Joseph ends up being purchased by Potiphar. Strange, Potiphar is the captain of the guard. It's like the head of the personal bodyguard of Pharaoh. He's like the head of the CIA or the FBI. It's his job to watch after the Pharaoh, and Joseph prospers in the house of Pharaoh. Wow. I mean, he does well in the house of Pharaoh. But then if you remember the story, Potiphar's wife takes a liking to Joseph, and she decides that she wants Joseph, and Joseph refuses her, and he makes some wonderful statements about how could I do this to Potiphar? You know, he's put everything in my hands. He trusts me with everything, and how could I do this to God? How could I betray God in this way? So you already see, even in this tragedy that is Joseph's life, that Joseph does not see it quite the way you and I might see it, or the way we would say, hey, I can understand that he sees it that way. Certainly Joseph understands pain. He understands, the disappointment of not being in his father's house anymore. He's 17 years old. I mean, what a difficult thing to do to a teenager. But Joseph prospers in that house, and now he's thrown into prison. Not just any prison. He goes into Pharaoh's prison because, remember, Potiphar is the head of the secret service for Pharaoh. So there's a special political prison and a place where those who were of importance would have been put, different from the normal prison. And he's thrown into this prison, and it ends up being only a setup for Joseph to prosper further. And it's not long before he's in charge of the prison. And then two of Pharaoh's aides are thrown into prison, his chief baker and his cupbearer, and they are put in Joseph's charge. He is supposed to watch after them, and he does, only to later interpret their dreams. And if you remember, 2 years later, the cupbearer of Pharaoh remembers when Pharaoh has a dream, oh, there was a guy. There was a guy who can interpret dreams. In fact, that guy, I told him, I won't forget about you, you know, and here I've forgotten about him. And so Joseph comes out, he interprets the dream of Pharaoh. And then this, I think it's just such a great part of the story, because we forget how God used the pain, the adversity, the struggle, and the restrictions on Joseph's life to build the character of Joseph. And to make that character even more pronounced than it could possibly be before. So that everyone realizes, Potiphar realized it, the warden in the prison realized it. Now Pharaoh will get to see that Yahweh is with Joseph, which means this: wherever Joseph lands, he prospers. As bad as it is, as much as you think, you know, that was a really terrible thing, Joseph prospers in those places. And Joseph understands, and he lives as if Yahweh is with him, as if Yahweh will watch after him. Isn't that a challenge? Let's be honest. It's a challenge for me, because there's so many things that I don't like. It's not how I picked it. You know, this is, why would it go this way? And it's so easy to just fall into that, and to somehow think that your life is not a concern of God's. There's no one watching after me who cares for me in that way. And yet Joseph is living his life differently, so that when he interprets the dreams, so there's going to be 7 years where it's going to be amazing. In fact, just to let you know how amazing it would be, if you look down in Egypt on that side, see those little fingers going up toward the Mediterranean Sea? Those are tributaries, are parts of the Nile River. And the Nile River goes down to the south. It is over 4,200 miles long, longest river in the world. And the Nile River is the most potent river in the world as far as farming, agriculture, because the Nile River every year would overflow, and all the junk and the organic material in the Nile River would all be pushed out to the sides, so that populations flourished along the Nile River. 4,200 miles of Nile River coming from the central part of Africa all the way up to the Mediterranean Sea. And just to let you know, the power of Egypt, which had to do with the power of the prosperity that came through the Nile River. This is why they were so advanced and so powerful, that this river goes from the south to the north. I know you think that is strange. I'll let you go look that up and figure that part out. There's a reason for that. So much so that the upper part of Egypt is called the Lower Kingdom, and the lower part of Egypt is called the Upper Kingdom, because it has to do with the flow of the Nile River, not what you and I think of would be north and south. So it prospered. And so the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, would be the most powerful person in the world. And Joseph is thrown into this place. And even in this part of the story, you have to ask this question, why Egypt? Canaan is the promised land. Why Egypt? Because in the 7 years of plenty, Egypt really prospers. It is a place of agriculture. Canaan is not. It's a place where all the crops grew like they never had grown before, and it just flourished and in abundance. And Joseph had the integrity that Pharaoh did not believe, if you read the text, apparently did not believe anybody in his kingdom would have to prepare and put food away so that when the 7 years of famine would come, Egypt would be prepared, because not even in Egypt did anything grow anymore. I have a friend, he was telling me about, you know the movie The Field of Dreams, Kevin Costner, from the baseball movie, and the famous line, you know, out of the movie, what's the famous line out of the movie, what? Yes, there you go, build it and they will come, you know. So he builds a field there in this middle of this cornfield, and it's interesting, I was told that when they did this, a drought kind of hit. So, you know, they wanted this beautiful cornfield and nothing was growing. And so they're like, oh man, what do we do? Well, what do? You irrigate, right? You got to bring in water. They did more than that. They actually brought in tankers filled with cow manure, liquefied, right? You know, you water it down so that they can spray cow manure everywhere. That sounds exciting. And but the ground loves it. And the corn loves it. And if you look in the movie, they said that's why the corn in the movie is incredible, the size of it and what it looks like. And everybody in the area came to look at it because they'd never seen corn grow like this before. Yeah, because it's kind of like the Nile River. It had overflowed with cow manure. In this case, you know, I guess alligator manure and hippo manure, you know, come out of the Nile, yeah? And everything grows. And so God strategically places Joseph in a place. He's watching after his life even more than you and I think. Because God knows that the day will come when Joseph will be the rescuer, not only of his own people in Canaan, but Joseph will be the rescuer of all of Egypt and all those surrounding areas. And this is the hand of God. This is something that God does, and something that how God moves. And the reason I point this out, and I think this is so important for you to grasp and for me to grasp, is you don't know about your life. You don't know why God has moved you to the place he's moved you. You don't know why you've gone through what you've gone through, maybe even the betrayal that you feel like you've gone through, or the lack of opportunity that you think, you know, you found yourself in. Joseph would have thought the same thing. Man, I was doing great in Canaan, favored son. Now I'm here. And yet God had other possibilities for Joseph's life. And Joseph lived like this. It wasn't just, you know, something one day he figured out. Joseph lived like this. And the truth is, most of us miss this part. And you would say, well, how would we know? Yeah, I agree. But this is why God reveals himself, and this is why God tries to make himself known to us, because the key to this in Joseph's life is knowing that God is with you and that he watches after you. It's not knowing how it's all going to work out. It's just knowing that the one who knows how it's all going to work out and who does control and direct the hands of pharaohs, the weather, the climates, who controls everything that we think, if we could just control, that the God who is over those things, when he watches after our life and we put our hope and our trust in him, it's a totally different story how we approach life and how we live our life, even in the midst around us when the world feels like it's in tragedy and everything is falling apart. I told you last week that I think the most difficult things to change in a person's life, my life too, is to change your perspective or to change your loyalty in life, because we grow up with a perspective and we tend to continue it and we tend to want to protect our perspective because we want to say, I was right. And all of a sudden when that changes and you have to see it in a different way than you saw it before, that's a radical thing, but it's a wonderful thing. And that involves a change of loyalties, you know, because even Pharaoh notices that the God of Joseph is with him and is watching after him. So Joseph is here. His brothers come down looking for food, if you know the story. And Joseph sends them back with some food, but he keeps Simeon, and he says, bring me Benjamin, the younger brother that you did not bring with you. And but he gave him the money back. They come back, this time with Benjamin. He sends him back once again, and this time he puts his own cup, has it put in Benjamin's pack, so that when the guards go after them and bring them back, he is found guilty of stealing Joseph's cup. But Joseph has a plan. And Joseph has been testing his brothers because he does not know where they're at or what's going on with their life. And all of a sudden you come to this 45th chapter in Genesis. And I think it's the most wonderful and the most powerful and the most emotional part of Genesis, and especially Joseph's story. And I hope you can tell I'm a little fired up about it. I hope you'll catch it also. Look at what he says. This is in verse number 1. It says, Joseph could stand it no longer. He's in front of his brothers. And he says, there were many people in the room. And he said to his attendants, out, all of you. So all of the Egyptian servants he had and other officials that would have always been around him because of his position, he sends them away so that he was alone with his brothers when he told them who he was. Then he broke down and he wept. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians could hear him. And word of it quickly carried all the way to Pharaoh's palace. That'll play later in the chapter. You'll see why this is so important. And this is what he says in verse number 3. He says, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers were speechless. Well, yeah. They were stunned to realize that Joseph was standing there in front of them. So I want you to catch just the magnitude of, you know, this that's going on. They have no idea who he is. They haven't seen him for 23 years. Joseph, you know, I'll get in trouble again. He walks like an Egyptian, right? He talks like an Egyptian. He looks like an Egyptian. He is in the power place of an Egyptian. They are nomads. They don't look anything like him. They don't talk anything like him. He has powerful people around him. For him to send everyone out and to start weeping and crying and saying, I am Joseph, your brother. Just think of not only his emotion, which is exploding in his life before his brothers, think of the emotion of the brothers. Now, their emotion gets them to do this. Because it is racing through their minds, right? Oh, my goodness. Is this possible? Because maybe he heard the stories. Maybe, you know, from the things they've already said, he has thought, hey, this would be a good little test to throw at them. And maybe he's messing with us in this way. Is it possible that the brother that we never said we sold into slavery, who would be taken to Egypt, is it possible that somehow he has not only survived, somehow he has prospered and risen to this position? Is this at all possible? And if it is, we're toast, right? We have been found out. We're about to see, you know, a retribution like retribution has never been dealt out before. And just think of this has gone on for months that he's brought them back and forth, probably for the better part of a year. Just think of the buildup and the time he's had to plan all the evils he is about to put back on us in payback for everything that we have done with him. And they see Joseph just explode in this emotion, and they are absolutely stunned. So here's my question. I think this would be a fun one to think about. Why is it that Joseph finds this kind of tipping point in his life now? What is it that would cause him to decide this is the moment and this is the time? And I think it's what he said. Is my father still alive? Because you don't realize so many times, no matter how good it gets, as well as how bad it gets, how attached you still are to your parents, to your father. So Joseph was the favored son. Joseph was watched after by Jacob. Jacob did a lot of things, you know, that weren't a good pattern of how to raise his kids. But he loved Joseph, and Joseph is still attached to his father, Jacob. And he has to know, is my father still alive in these midst? I think that's what kind of kicks him over the edge with his brothers. Then it goes on to say this in the next verse. He says, please come closer. And I would think, uh-oh, you know, he's got bad things planned. Come closer, he said to them. So they came closer. And he said again, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into slavery in Egypt. Oh my. But don't be upset. What do you mean don't be upset? Are you kidding me? What? How could you say don't be? We've been found out. We've been caught. But listen to what he says. Don't be upset. And don't be angry with who? Yourselves. Because, you know, that would be the natural response that you would hope for, that they would be angry with themselves for what they've done, for selling him. It was God, he says, who sent me here ahead of you to preserve your lives. This famine that has ravaged the land for 2 years will last 5 more years, and there will be neither plowing nor harvest. God has sent me ahead of you to keep you and your families alive and to preserve many survivors. So it was God who sent me here, not you. And he is the one who made me an advisor to Pharaoh, the manager of his entire palace and the governor of all Egypt. So he's not saying this was Pharaoh's idea. He's not saying it was your idea. He's not saying it. He's saying, listen, it was Yahweh's idea. Wow. What a revelation. And what a change that the whole scene, you know, takes with this idea of not revenge, not retribution, not loyalty, you know, to the powers of Egypt, but loyalty to Yahweh, who has watched after my life and moves pharaohs, kings, whoever he wants to accomplish his purposes in life. And he says, here's the purposes, to rescue you guys. And so there'll be a lot of survivors of this. And to rescue, he not only rescues their family, he rescues all of Egypt and the lands around them through this. And that's why I thought, you know, it's worth saying sometimes, how did we miss it? How did we miss it? And yet the truth is we do miss it. We go through life and it takes a lot of events sometimes for us to wake up and to realize, oh my goodness, how did we miss it? But there it is. Joseph is hidden to them, right? And now Joseph is revealed. Joseph has taken the truth and he's held it close to himself. And now all of a sudden, Joseph reveals the truth of who he is. Joseph has different plans than they would have had as people, really than the Egyptians would have had. I mean, you go read Egyptian history, it was dangerous to be Egyptian royalty. You know, you could be assassinated or murdered, you know, very quick because of the power of it. And somehow Joseph is different in this position of power than anybody that they understood before. I think it's this strange thing that happens where somehow something we did not believe could happen, truth, what is right, righteousness, what is good, we don't see those as being able to collide somehow with compassion and emotion and the things that we also realize need to be there. We see those things as being separated, and you can't have one and have the other. But in Joseph, you're going to see those two come together. Truth, compassion, grace, and what is right, what is real. The feeling part of it will come with the reality part of it, the logical part of it, and somehow come together. Now, the reason I think this is important is because this is who God is. And God encompasses both, even though we don't ever understand it. We can't quite understand it. In fact, I hear people, you know, they'll do this, and I understand why they do it. They go to the Old Testament and say, listen, how can you believe in a God like the God of the Old Testament? Well, so a God who is truthful and compassionate in a world that is a mess, and somehow they've confused the two. It's not God that's the mess, it's the world that's the mess. And let's be honest, as much as we would like to think, you know, we are the last generation, we are the holders of all goodness and truth, we'd like to think that, come on, Seriously? We're a mess. We're just a smarter mess. We are a wealthier mess. We are a more high-tech mess. But we still struggle with the same things that mankind has struggled with all the way back 4,200 years ago. It's not any different unless God invades, unless God comes and makes a difference. In fact, if you think about it, there are a lot of parallels to Joseph's life and the revelation here of Joseph to the life of Jesus also, right? Because Jesus is born into the world some, 2,000 years after this, and Jesus is hidden from them. They don't realize it's the Son of God. I was telling some guys yesterday morning that were meeting, I said, if you were there, if I was there, and you were one of the brothers or the stepbrothers or stepsisters of Jesus had stepbrothers and stepsisters. There was a family that was born after he was born to Mary. And if you were one of those, would you have believed that Jesus was the Son of God? And I told him, not me. There's something about saying my brother is the Son of God that I'm not going to do that. He's my brother, and I'm not lifting him up because I can show you things, right? Because that's just the way we're wired. That's just the way we are. We struggle with it. And when all of a sudden you see God do something and reveal himself as he did through his son Jesus as he sent him into the world, it's stunning. It's like, whoa, this changes everything about life. If God would come and live among us and invade our world, not only with truth, but with the ultimate of compassion, emotion, a feeling with us. I know you've heard before, don't live on your feelings, live on logic. Or you've heard, church people or religious people, don't live on your emotion, live on your faith instead. You have to live on both. It's just how are you going to live with both is the question, because they're both there. And if you think you can get rid of one, then you're living in a fantasy world. You are feeling emotion-oriented, and you are logical and truth-oriented enough to say, I can figure some things out. If I just see them clearly, I can grasp some things. And he brings them both together to change our world. In fact, it may be the most unimaginable equation that we have. They can both come together. Yes, they can. And when they do, it is powerful. It is powerful. It was powerful with Joseph and his brothers. They are stunned by the whole thing. This is a reversal of everything they have known and understand about life and how you act and what you do and where it goes and how it works out. Wow. John, who's writes one of the most understandable gospels for Western thinkers. If you want to read one of the gospels, I always recommend go to the Gospel of John first as a Western thinker, because he writes in a way that makes sense to us. In the very first chapter, John goes in and he tries to explain, how it started or how it came about. And then he comes across this incredible statement that's there, the 14th verse of the first chapter. I think it'll pop up on the screen. There it is. And read this with me. Read this with me if you would. And he says, and the Word became what? Yeah. Now, word means the logic of it, the thinking of it, the truth of it, what's real, what's right. All of that concept somehow became flesh. And he says, and then it did what? And it lived here. It's my stepbrother. it's my brother Joseph that I thought was dead. I thought we had sold him. We're trying to hide this fact. It becomes real. Right? It's truth. And we wouldn't want it to become truth because the emotion of it. And the emotion of it is the very opposite of what we thought it would be when Joseph is revealed. And he says, and we saw his, don't you love this word, we saw his what? His glory. That means the wonder of who he is. The thing that just blows us away about who he is. Glory as of the only begotten of the Father, the one and only, full of two things. What is it? Grace and can't be. You can't be full of both, right? It's got to be one or the other. You're either compassionate or you're truthful. You either believe in kind of righteousness or you believe in, some sort of compassion, toward it. Oh, yeah, both have come together in a way that we cannot fully conceive of. But God reveals himself in this way. for us so that our concept would be different. Then he goes on to say this. He sees his family, and he feels still this incredible attachment to his family. And so he says this, "Now hurry back to my father and tell him, this is what your son Joseph says. God has made me master over all the land of Egypt." He didn't say, "I figured it out," or "I'm so smart," or "I'm so..." He says, and he didn't say, "Pharaoh has," even though Pharaoh did. But he is acknowledging that God has put me in this place. "So come down to me immediately. You can live in the region..." I love this word, Goshen. Don't you love that word? You can live in Goshen. You know, it's just... Is there a Goshen, Texas? There should be. Okay, so Goshen is in that delta area up in the north that I was talking about, and it's the most prosperous of the prosperous. This is the place, because of all the tributaries, where they could grow like they had never grown before. And in this place, their family will be planted. Not Canaan, where the promised land is. They have been moved to Goshen. And again, I know you're going to think, why Egypt? But just think about it for a minute. So Abraham and Sarah have one child that was a child of promise. His name was what? Isaac. So one family, you know, has now born one child. Okay, great. This is an empire, right? This is a great nation. And this one son, Isaac, has one son that is part of the promise. He said Esau, and then the father here, Jacob. And then Jacob gets his name changed to Israel. It's not like other name changes. This name is a name like a national name. So he's still Jacob, but he is Israel, because Israel will now become a nation. But we've gone through several generations, and we're still down to a pretty small group, you know. So how is this going to work? I don't understand how a nation would be built from this, or how it would affect the world. But all of a sudden, he has 12. Whew. And if you read later in the story, you're going to see that 72 actually move to Goshen. So it has already expanded tremendously. And for the next 400 years, they will be in a place of prosperity and a place of growing and a place of just multiplying, so that some historians believe that 400 years later, as many as 2.5 to 3 million people walk out of Egypt. Now, think about it. I know you may think, I don't know if I believe that. Well, you just go do the math real quickly, and you find out that nomadic or farming type communities, if you're having a dozen kids or so, or a dozen boys or so, you can multiply it pretty fast, because it doubles and doubles and doubles and doubles, and the numbers increase incredibly fast, so much so that Egypt is caught off guard. And they're going, they're in Goshen, there's this people, they are enormous. I mean, there are a lot of them, and they had invaders come from the land of Canaan before and afterwards. And if they come down invading, trying to take over and conquer Egypt, because Egypt is the place to conquer, it is so prosperous and the possibilities are so amazing. If they come through and grab the Hebrew people on the way, there's another 2.5 million fighting for them. This is a bad thing. Let's beat them down. Let's kind of do what the brothers did, right? Let's find a way to slow them down and make life hard on them so they can't continue to prosper. But God had a different plan. And almost secretly, he grows a nation. It's stunning, because, you know, Egypt would have said the same thing. Why didn't we see this coming? How did we miss this, that this nation has grown up in our midst that we now view as a threat? You know, not an asset. But God has done his planting. He is moving them as he chooses. So he goes on to say, "You can live in the land of Goshen, where you can be near me. And all your children and your grandchildren, your flocks, your herds, everything you own, I will take care of you there. There are still 5 years of famine ahead of us. Otherwise, you and your household, all your animals, they will starve." Then Joseph added, "Look, you can see for yourselves, and so can my brother Benjamin. I really am Joseph. Go tell my father of my honored position here in Egypt. Describe for him everything you have seen, and then bring my father here quickly." Weeping with joy, Joseph embraces Benjamin, and Benjamin did the same. Then Joseph kissed each of his brothers, and he wept over them. And after that, they began talking freely with him. Now, here's the truth of it, the way it should work. Joseph has the power. Joseph is in charge. But Joseph recognizes that God is really the one with power, that God is the one really in charge. So his concern still is to initiate, and it's his place to initiate the same way that God has initiated with him. And now all of a sudden, as he does that, there are those who are receiving, and then they can be responders to the grace that is given to them, that is poured out to them. That means they have an opportunity to do the same, to live the same. The reason I say that, listen, if you are a believer, if you understand who Jesus Christ is and what God did for you when he sent Jesus Christ into the world 2,000 years ago, and the change that God initiates, and you have received that grace that comes from God as a gift from God, then you get a chance to be someone who responds not just to people. Yeah, you can respond to people. You can return evil for evil. You can lash out and seek revenge. You can find things that separate you from other people, or you can be someone who responds with the grace that was extended to you and given to you, the way Joseph responds to his brothers. And he's giving them hope. It's not that they're going to live in Egypt for the rest of their lives, but Egypt is a place of God's rescue, and it's weird, isn't it? Because who would have thought God would rescue his people in Egypt? But he does, because it's not the end of the story. He still has every plan to move them back. And your story is the same way. Where God places you and where you are and how you got there, listen, that's not the end of the story. But there's still a God who watches and who cares and who moves and who changes things. And there's still chapters to be written. There are things ahead. And from you, others will learn to respond to grace because you decided to extend grace to someone else. It doesn't change righteousness. Grace just sort of trumps righteousness, doesn't it? Just overcomes it because of the compassion that God feels and how that compassion is combined with truth and righteousness, the truth and righteousness of who God is, so that our lives have changed. So I want you to do this with me this morning. Just for a minute, let's pray. But here's what I want you to do for a minute. You can probably think of people in your life or people that you know that you say, boy, they could use some grace. They could use some compassion. Guess whose mind that just popped into? Maybe you're the one that could extend some compassion and grace to that person because you understand. You see it. You know what it would be like to be in their shoes. There are a lot of people in the world all around us that are going through an incredible amount of pain and suffering and who have. And some of them have suffered for doing the right thing, similar to what Joseph did. And that means we can pray for them. We can remember them. We can ask God to be with them and for God to open the eyes of people that they would see that there is a God of grace and love and compassion. Truth and grace come together who came for them also. So would you pray with me? And dear Heavenly Father, we do thank you that you change the story. You do flip the script on us because you're capable, you're powerful, and you can set things up in ways that we never even thought they could be set up. Just to show, just to make it clear that you are the one who brings the change. And you're the one who pours out the grace into this world that the world desperately needs, as you have done through your Son, Jesus Christ, so that our hearts are changed. We are broken by your great love and compassion for us. And because of that, we realize you are compassionate and gracious toward others. So, Father, use us with our neighbors, people that we know. Rather than responding the way that we feel like it or sometimes the way we see it, Lord, would you change our perspective. If you're here and you've never put your trust in Jesus Christ, the good news is that Jesus Christ is still alive. He's still living. He still changes the hearts of people who look and they see Him and they recognize who He is and what He's capable of. If you're here and you're looking for an answer, you're looking for something that would truly make a difference, that's why He sent His one and only, to make a difference in our hearts so that we could then make some kind of difference in the hearts and the lives of other people. You can say, Lord Jesus, thank You. Thank You for going through all the pain and the sacrifice that You went through, all the punishment to go through even this life, to never fail, but to stay true and holy and righteous, only so that You could offer that life to set me free. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.